Hello again. It's Michonne Neal, your resident gentleman goddess, and we're going to do yet another episode of Integrated Non-Monogamy. So, sit tight and yes, let this earworm fill you. So there's this term that I really like to use called unchained. And some other people use it, but I would like for you to know what I mean when I use it. So before I knew the words non-monogamy, polyamory, relationship anarchy, and open relationship and other terms like that, I just lived it organically. And due to my locus within various systematic oppressions, the difficulties that I encountered had nothing to do with jealousy or dismantling a metanormativity or the, you know, the can't find a date woes. When I finally did discover the mainstream non-mono communities, I actually grew so disgusted with the unexamined and rather abusive approaches to love that were running rampant. So I did what I always do, which is to create something that got to the root and that restored the queer black history of non-monogamy, and also that promoted an educated consent model that was lacking pretty much anywhere else. Intersectional non-monogamy was not meant to be some buzzword which was watered down and co-opted like compersion usually is. It was a specific lens through which to view the world, an action-oriented set of practices. And the origin goes way beyond the surface to start from the very root of all of our definitions of love, loyalty, needs, and ethics. Right? And that's what I mean. It's really puzzling that there are a lot of, especially non-black people, using intersectional non-monogamy to describe certain things or to try to have or lead discussions about it. And it makes no sense, because how can you speak to something that's not your experience and that you haven't ever really been, nobody's asked them to talk about this. I don't know. At least not the people who have the experience, you know? I mean, it's one thing, but if you're going to be a spokesperson for it, you should probably, you know, consult the people who, the main people. I don't know. Anyway. So unlike many poly-A folks, I never transitioned into being non-monogamous. I had always liked or loved more than one person and always been an organic multi-linker. It never made sense to me to arbitrarily limit affection, love, and time into one person. The idea of expecting one person to be everything you wanted and needed was strange to me. It still is, honestly. Things like veto power, identifying primarily as a couple, and making assumptions were never the norm for me. In some ways, it's difficult for me to conceive of the things that do make people jealous, and that sense of ownership of another person in particular, and those rules that are set up to protect relationships instead of people. I have always valued autonomy, questioned every assumption, and approached people as human beings first and foremost. I want the truth most of all, no matter how much it hurts, because I've survived worse. My time is so precious, and each moment is new. Yet the majority of people don't experience the world this way. Where I performed thought experiments and tracked ideas to their logical conclusions, other people must work layer by layer to get in touch with what lies beneath society's veneer. I never viewed relationships as being either or. I let people I was interested in know how I felt, and then I let them do with the information whatever the hell they pleased. I never spent months or years dancing around the issue and wondering, what if? I found that most people simply said no, either right off the bat or later on after a bit of trying, because they couldn't quite get the hang of polyamory, or because they thought that they had to respect my relationship with my longer-term partner. But it was never because they didn't realize that they had other options. Or at least not for it wasn't a lack of me letting them know they had other frickin' options. I remained friends with those who wanted to and let others go. I don't know if being aromantic and autistic makes this kind of thing easier for me than others, but it probably has something to do with it, since I'm not quite caught up in all of the, you know, the usual social norms and things, you know? I just do what makes sense. My relationships, including those of my teen years and even preteen years, you know? Basically, every relationship that I've had, you know, probably had my first boyfriend at age 5, but even then, none of my relationships ever ended dramatically. There was no yelling or screaming or attempted murder, though there have been tears sometimes. There was one guy who was not my partner, but we did end up having to beat him up because there were some extenuating circumstances. It was a person I think met with like once, and it was just, yeah. Anyway, I can go over that sometime much later. The point is, the people that I was with, we never broke up because somebody else demanded that we do it. Each relationship that I ever had ran its natural course. Most of them ended amicably, even if they ended sadly. The one that ended very abruptly was, of course, when my partner unexpectedly died. But other than that, there was no real drama in the endings of any of my relationships. They just developed or shifted organically. With my longest term partner, there was some issue with that. There was very high possibility of abuse for one of our kids, and so I basically had to remove them from the situation until I could figure out what the hell was going on. And of course, my parents stepped in a very not helpful way, and my partner ended up going to jail. But it's, you know, but you know, the point is, there's no, even now, there's no, like, animosity or ill will between us, at least not on my part. You know, and we are just doing our best to make sure the kids are taken care of and everything. Don't exactly consider ourselves partners anymore, but it's just, I don't know, it's this nebulous space that we're not allowed to exist in, right? Things always have to be fucking defined and shit, but I don't know, whatever. I know we're going to be in each other's lives probably for, you know, the rest of our lives. I don't mind that. In what capacity and in what levels? Who knows? That's for us to fucking figure out later. Anyway, but see, because I know, knowing firsthand what it is to have a lack of choice and lack of self-determination, I always made sure to offer space and a free choice to those who are in my life. And this is what the norm would be under a decolonized or completely uncolonized culture. Many stories in the Kuhlverse are actually built upon non-coercion, organicity over a matter of normativity, and on the notion that friendship as being valuable in and of itself. There were problems. Of course, there were incompatibilities, as always, you know. There was some jealousy, but it never fell on another person to fix someone else's issues. There were no sides taken. There was no ganging up on one person. No holding of any one relationship above the individuals that were in them. It was simply us talking about expectations, feelings, and needs. Oh, you know what? Isn't it the kind of shit that, you know, especially people within polyamory are always touting that they want to do, and yet nobody ever seems to actually fucking do it? I don't know, whatever. The point is, when we learned that, we wanted or expected different things, I would thank them for the experience and then release them to the universe to find what the fuck they actually wanted. It didn't stop it from hurting. It didn't mean that things weren't exciting. yeah, like the like the bit I mentioned earlier about the kid's dad, you wouldn't fucking believe some of the crazy shit that my longest term partners and I've been through together experienced, and they're just me by myself, like, seriously. But, you know, like I said, it's another story, and maybe I'll talk about it someday. Maybe I will invite him on here to discuss it. Who knows? We'll see. If there's interest in it, I guess I can do that. It's whatever. Anyway, from a very, very early age, I was used to being alone. I was always very close with my siblings. My older sister and I are still thick as thieves, and we raise our children together on and off. But, you know, still, I spend the majority of my time alone. It's just the nature of the, you know, being multiply marginalized and having multiple disabilities, especially with chronic pain and all that. It just does not leave much time for the quote-unquote niceties of life. When you're poor and fucked up, it's kind of hard to get out and do stuff, you know? Anyway, so on top of a multitude of experiences that were and presently are unique to me, I knew that the only constants in my life were going to be solitude and change. I enjoy people as they come. I never ask for more than anyone can give. And I let them know off the bat that I wouldn't be owned or boxed in. And that's from the very beginning. Unfortunately, this often means that I end up in a teacher or therapeutic role for other people. I'd be the one they came to for advice. And I had to learn to set, I did have to learn to set new boundaries. For those who just tended to want to use me as a sounding board and not, you know, like, just because. And that's the thing, too, is this whole conceptualization of friendship as just being something different than at least how I conceive it to be, you know. For me, a friendship is so much more than a romantic relationship could be, and it requires other things, but people aren't used to that. And so if you are a friend, you're either a dumping ground or you're somebody they can get certain things from, or somebody they can forget things with, or things like that, you know. But that's not how I roll. Anyway, I mean, it could be because I'm left-handed and autistic. You know, but I've always been a very highly compassionate person. And many people, even strangers, sense this. The broken, they all want and need help. It took me way too many years to finally admit I couldn't save anyone, nor did I want to. I definitely didn't want anyone ever to try to save me, nor even understood what they thought they could save me from. I finally learned to extend that sort of educational autonomy to them as well. Because see, the best teacher is often nature itself. And no matter how helpful you are, you won't be around forever. It's good to assist people, but that person themselves, they have to do the heavy lifting. Because they are going to be the most reliable person that they'll ever know. So being able to limit my role as a crutch helped me better advocate for the relationships I actually wanted. The only thing that you owe to another person might be money. I mean, hello, reparations. Come on now. Everything else, it's voluntary. And I didn't, and still don't, demand respect, love, or any other resource from anyone. But the people that I invest in, they offer these things freely because they choose to. That longest-term partner I was telling you about, he started off wanting to save me. Later on, felt he had a duty to me, which, felt that he had to repay his debt to me somehow. I shot him down every time, every single time. No matter what, I want to be chosen, not needed, owned, or owed. I started rather early in my life, around age 12, when I first started writing, and, you know, nearly two decades later, it's become much easier to express and discuss in particulars what it is that I am open to. I don't even want to say seeking or, you know, or whatever, because I'm just, it's the connection is going to be based on the dynamic between me and that person, and what we want to, what we can, and what we want to build together. Nothing about my life has ever been remotely normal. And as I look around at other people's stories, I realize that definitely includes my love life. So this is the overview. Maybe one day I will tell you the whole tale. And if you want to see some of this in practice, my stories are full of atypical yet intersectional relationships. Even a few of my own. So I think it's past time that we dismantle the frickin' triangular theory of love. Because, let's face it, it's not fucking consummate. You know, the triangular theory of love is consummate love is supposed to be made up of intimacy plus passion plus commitment. But the problem is a romantic, autistic, and asexual spectrum people often get left out of all the popular theories and all the convenient graphs about love, lust, and romance. The triangular theory of love is no exception. Theories tend to evolve over time as new information is uncovered. It would be very nice one day to have more widespread knowledge out there about all of the possibilities, and not merely those open to the chosen few. I mean, come on, we hear about the same types of people and the same types of things over and over again. And how can you ever truly explore something new or something different if you're not talking to the people who are out on the fringes or who were once celebrated but are now, like, just fucking left out, you know? Anyway, aromantic people, autistic people, asexuals, and black people who are all of those, definitely tend to get swept under the rug. Experiences that fall outside of the romantic norm are not well understood, and I doubt they're well documented. The largest problem starts with the conflation of passion with limerence / infatuation, or what most people often refer to as new relationship energy. The idea that someone can love someone intensely without feeling romantic or sexual, that someone can remain unbelievably excited about someone for longer than a few months, or that the passion can even grow over time is pretty much unheard of. So many people, whether monogamous or polyamorous, talk about passion as something that's like an addiction, something that wears off with time, and something that can only be felt at the beginning of a relationship. So what does passionate, non-romantic love look like? How is it different from both romantic passion and companionship? What would you even call it? And is it actually possible? There has been a steady reintroduction of and recognition that there are more types of attraction than previously thought, or at least within, you know, colonized time. Many people are usually familiar with romantic, emotional, and sexual attraction, but may not be familiar with sensual attraction, aesthetic attraction, as opposed to mere aesthetic appreciation, and quote-unquote intellectual attraction. The Thinking Arrow is a site that has this lovely long list of terms and definitions for all sorts of experiences and identities if you need any explanations of anything that I mentioned. I will clearly state that their content is not intersectional, and it's actually downright harmful in some places, but the Thinking Arrow has contributed much to the language and to gathering the language and terminology around asexuality and aromanticism, as well as written a lot on polyamory, albeit from an extremely white point of view. And though they cover many types of attraction and relationship forms, there still isn't much out there to accurately describe enduring connections throughout the relationship, or at least without using terms normally related to the most common understandings of commitment, intimacy, and passion, which leave out the ways that black people and asexuals and aromantics may experience those things. So I've mentioned before that I am asexual and aromantic, and also autistic, and black, of course. I am also noetosexual, which adds its own unique dimension to the ways that I experience attraction, love, and passion. I don't experience NRE, and I never have. Perhaps some of my long-lasting sexual and sensual attraction is bound up with my extremely high sex drive and my highly sensual nature. You know, of course, there's going to be a little bit of overlap there because I don't mind. But I can only be affectionate, sensual, and sexual with people that I trust, with people that I have some level of emotional intimacy with. Notably, none of these necessarily follow from any other, nor do any of these types of love and connection require any attraction to feel them. I can connect with or feel deeply emotionally or mentally attached to people regardless of any attraction between us or lack thereof. Can you envision the possibilities for community building yet? So, to put it another way, just as action doesn't follow from attraction, neither does one sort of love, emotion, or attraction automatically follow from any other. There are as many ways to connect and feel desire as there are people on the planet, and probably more. I'll explain more about attraction and aromanticism specifically later on, because I know that that is all that most people care about, especially when we're discussing relationships. But for now, I simply wanted to go over three types of love or attachment that aromantic, autistic, and or asexual people, and perhaps even some romantic and sexual people of a few different races, might experience, but that they may never have had a name for. The point is to expand our understanding about love, attraction, boundaries, and desire so that truly informed consent becomes the norm and not the assumption. So many ACEs may tend to avoid relationships with sexual people, and many aromantics may avoid hanging around romantic people, and autistic people may avoid getting involved with allistic people because of these overly simplified explanations of love, lust, and the built-in assumptions of an end goal along the touch and relationship escalators. So the seemingly inevitable escalation in a series of steps of either touch towards sex or steps of a relationship toward marriage or / life partnership. If you're unfamiliar with the touch and relationship escalators, they're two different things. The relationship escalator was, I think, coined by Aggie Says, that's kind of the only useful thing that that's happened with. Oh, that's a story for another time. But anyway, and the touch escalator was coined by the thinking A-roll. Anyway, until our experiences are made visible, alloromantic and allosexual people, basically people who experience romantic attraction, people experience sexual attraction, they'll have problems creating consensual relationships of any form with aromantic, autistic, and asexual people. I also hope that many aromantics and asexuals feel empowered and informed enough to make conscious decisions about how they want their relationships of any form to look and what they involve. As I've written before on my blogs, there are no defaults in relationships, save for friendship being inherently non-monogamous, but, you know, hopefully you catch my drift. So while these terms are intended to be living terms that I'm about to bring up, and other people's experiences may be slightly different, I would still like to share three terms that I created that explain the sorts of passion or attachment I experience and what that's like. And then after that, I want to share a term by a wonderful autistic and disabled friend of mine, who just created, it just sums it up perfectly, and it's specifically for autistic people, so it's just like, ah. Anyway, so the first type of affection or slash connection is what I would like to call ecstatic love or ecstatic attachment. It's basically like the opposite of existential terror. It's like this deep, permeating existential joy that this other person or several people exist. It's deeper than typical friendship, yet it's not romantic and not sexual in any way. It kind of feels like being tickled by the notion of this person being alive right then and there. It may or may not fade with time, and often there's no accompanying outward sign, though the thought of them may bring smiles to your face. It's just a feeling that underlies all of your interactions with others that inspire the feeling. It's like the fierce love that you feel for your child, but it can be felt for those who aren't, and without the parental or the protective or instinctive elements accompanying it. And as with anything else, it also does not require you to be attracted to this person in some way. The second term, I refer to it as rapturous love or rapturous attachment. And it's like this slow building wave. So whereas infatuation is often accompanied by extreme highs and lows, and it dissipates after a while, and obsession is often characterized by need and control, rapturous love and attachment is, it simply grows and grows and grows without the desire to restrict the person or people in any way. And the more time that passes, the more overwhelmed you may feel. It's this joy that just keeps building on itself with time, this fullness and excitement that only increases as time passes. For me, it makes me want to touch and or fuck, if applicable, the person or people more and more, not less and less. So the more time we spend together, and the more I know you, and the more we mentally connect, the more that I want you and enjoy you physically and emotionally. So as stated previously, attraction of any sort is not required to feel like this. It can be felt for any kind of friend. And this overlaps a bit with the last term, which is resonant love, or to be in resonance with someone. This one is extremely intimate. It goes down to the core. It is the full recognition of another person as they truly are, with no assumptions, judgments, or deceptions. It is the holy moment. I don't know if you've ever seen Waking Life. It's just this wonderful movie, and it involves this this just really sort of tender moment where two of the Oneironauts are discussing, you know, why don't we just bare our souls all the time? And we call those holy moments, when you just see the person, you know, you kind of see their soul. I don't know if a lot of people know what that feels like, but if you don't, it's, you know, it's amazing. I mean, I suppose romantic people only feel it with the romantic partners. I guess it's what makes you want to get married to somebody or something, I imagine. But it's not just the domain of romance or anything like that. So anyway, I don't know. It's like meeting the one, but everyone is the one. Or, you know, not everyone, but, you know, certainly isn't limited to just one person. Anyway, but it's this holy moment, and it can last for a glance, or it can last for a lifetime. You are both deeply aware of one another. It's as if your souls are naked and revealed when two or more points of the same universal soul meet. Now, I know that this might sound a little bit religious or spiritual, but that's not what I'm talking about. It can also simply be a meeting of minds, this like special rhythm that you get into when you both or all understand an idea or each other completely and entirely. So if this were Doctor Who, it would be one of the fixed points in time, an absolute. If you're black, it's the obligatory head nod to another black person. The term brain orgasms also works for the shorter holy moments, though it can last for much longer, of course. So many people might only feel this for a moment here or there, but it can actually be felt and experienced quite often, if not all the time. But as the two men in the conversation in that movie that I mentioned, Waking Life, say, it is not considered polite to have holy moments, and especially not with people who aren't our romantic or sexual partners, or to whom we are not attracted in those or other ways. We tend to shy away from them because they're too raw, too honest, and too revealing. And those all go into my experience of being Noetta sexual, which of course deserves its own bit. All right, so there is also this amazing term. It's called Auti Love, and it was coined by the amazing Salem Gooseby of, what was it, Holding Patterns and High Tea. You should definitely check it out and tip them well. And so he came up with this autistic specific term for just describing the ways that autistic people in particular connect to one another. It is rooted in access intimacy, and I absolutely consider it a form of Noetta sexuality. And it's just fucking beautiful, because I mean, we're so often left out, and a lot of people think that autistic people are just cold and unfeeling. They think the same thing about aromantic people as well. And well, here we are, changing that narrative and finally able to, take up the space and speak for ourselves and create our own language, that we can understand and use with each other. So, I hope to include that definition and actually a few, at least one of the articles that Salem wrote in the second Eros book, which is going to kind of break down more of the meat end of things that were mentioned within the first book, and introduce a lot more terms, and hopefully find some other different perspectives, and just really break down, okay, so what are the actual issues that romantic and aromantic people stumble upon when they are in relationships together, and how do we really explore this together? So it's going to dig a little deeper. It's going to be a little bit more painful. It's going to mention one of my, a friendship that did end very, just not well. Actually, turned out that somebody in my friend circle was very, very abusive, and there were a lot of mitigating factors that occurred, and that was why I did not notice so much sooner. But like I said, more on all that later. For now, just ruminate on Auti Love, Auti Love. Oh my goodness, sorry, I'm so excited about it, I can't even spell it. But yeah, so feel free to check that out, and I will make sure to put a link to his site in in the description of the video. So description of the audio. Oh my goodness. Okay, well, thank you for joining me for yet another episode, and as always, feel free to pass it along or tip me or whatever. So
If you like what you're hearing and want to directly support me, there are now subscription options, monthly subscription options. So, sign up. And if you do, you might just find yourself with access to the Metanoic portal for free. Hey, that sounds pretty sweet to me. So go ahead, try it out.